Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. So kind of a combo podcast in regards to last week and this week. This week, of course, with the holiday around the corner. Last week, Leighton basically moving, so as a result, not a whole lot of time to record the podcast, so we're combining two in one. And a quick reminder, next week is our yearly rundown of the five highest performing retailers in our eyes and the five lowest performing retailers in our eyes, as well as saying goodbye to the retailers that declared bankruptcy, so you want to be sure and tune in for next week's episode as well. Good show today. We've got Costco coming up. We've also got news surrounding the pet retail industry and a look at dairy in grocery stores as the annual State of the Industry look for dairy was released by Food Business News. Also got a great interview about designing a grocery store in California, how you can kind of turn the traditional model of the grocery store and turn it into something better, not necessarily turn it upside down, but refine that model, as we'll talk to one of the chief designers of the newest Gelson's Market there in California. That's all coming up. And a quick reminder to like us or rate us wherever you do check us out, whether that be Podbean or Stitcher or Spotify or iTunes or Apple Podcasts, any one of those platforms. And also check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. So we lead this show with shares of Costco plummeting last Friday. Continued their decline this week in the overall market sell-off, a rough week for the stock market, but Costco among the retailers that were hit heavily. Costco missed analyst expectations for their 2019 first quarter in their latest earnings call. This despite putting forth latent what we would consider otherworldly same-store sales increases for an established retailer.
Yeah, shares were down about 8%, 8.5% on Friday after what we thought was pretty much another good quarter for Costco. Costco being one of those large brick and mortar retailers that we love to talk about when it comes to earnings season. But Costco reported net income of $767 million. This was on top of the same store sales figures that we'll get into. And they made $1.73 per diluted share compared to around $640 million in net income last year, or around $1.45 in comparable year-over-year diluted per share earnings. And you think that those numbers, or you would think that those numbers would be pleasing shareholders and analysts, but that just was not the talk around this earnings call. Adjusted earnings per share were $1.61, by the way, missing average analyst estimates by around one penny, or around 0.5%. So not a huge miss there either. So gross margins were partly to blame for that very mild miss, as the company reported theirs just over 10.7%, lower than the 11.25% during their first fiscal quarter of last year. And you could see that 10% or 11% gross margins, that seems already like a super low number. However, Costco and their accounting methodology, they do a lot of different things, stuff that retailers in general don't do. So typically we could see a company has between 25 and 35% gross margins. They factor in a lot more stuff on their expense reports. As such, you see that those percentages are much lower overall. However, looking at those comparable periods, that little bit of a miss there year over year, I think that really has to do with price competition. Costco is up against a number of retailers right now in the grocery space. And so historically, you think about Costco and Sam's Club as general merchandise retailers, big box retailers that have a treasure hunt experience, if you will, that sell a lot of hard lines and soft lines with their clothing. However, grocery has taken a huge portion of sales, and because of that, price competition has come to the forefront. It's a huge thing, and this is something that they talked about, or at least management talked about, during the formal earnings report, and that price competition is going to be something that they are going to have to take into consideration for the foreseeable future. So because groceries are a higher percentage of revenue, and because the competition within that niche of retail is utterly high right now, that number is probably either going to stay stagnant or continue to decline in terms of gross margins. Top line revenue increased 10% year over year to $35 billion, always a number that you would like to see with a mature retailer. Anytime you can get into double-digit territory at this point in time, especially in North America, you are on a winning strategy. And this was a function of both higher merchandise sales, but also membership income due to having more expensive memberships that, by the way, are renewing at all-time high rates. And typically with Costco, we see between 89 and 90% renewal rates. By the way, they do count renewals with members that come in 6 months, 7 months later after closing out their membership, coming back in the club and getting another membership. So technically, it's not a pure renewal, but still those numbers are right around 90.5% right now. By the way, this is a 10 basis point improvement for its U.S. business. So those U.S. customers, they are pleased with that product selection, in particular, that grocery assortment. Management noted that it usually takes 23 whole months to fully realize a typical membership rate increase. This was actually the first time we saw some clarity on this figure, because this is something we've talked about during the last two or three Costco earnings calls, was the fact that, you know what, it's going to take a while to fully realize this, because a lot of the members, they weren't yet renewing, so they weren't actually paying that extra premium for their membership, whether they had the executive membership or the base membership. They were waiting it out, and this was something we had speculated on the podcast in this very latest earnings call, the earnings call before this, saying that we didn't know if it was going to be an inelastic figure because they had went up at a time when we were thinking maybe it would have been better to put off an increase in the membership rate for another 1 to 2 years. Regardless, it seems to be working out. Costco's comps were strong in the U.S., coming in at 11%. This is exactly what we introed this story with, 11% comps. These are double-digit comps, again, from a very mature retailer in the United States. But you have to factor in, this has a lot to do with that membership renewal rate. A lot more people are coming to their stores. A lot more people, therefore, because of the higher basket size, are going to be contributing to those clubs that have existed for more than 1 year in a positive way. Canada's comps, by the way, only up a modest 2.4%, but there is a caveat. They market a lot less in Canada. That's not their bread and butter business. Canada, while it's always been a successful business for Costco, hasn't been their primary focus for a number of years, and I don't see it really taking hold over the next several either. But international markets overall, we mentioned Canada, but other international units, as they tend to talk about on their formal press releases, were positive overall, around 4 to 5% overall if you look at those international markets. They have one club in Iceland, by the way, so if you're an Iceland listener, which I highly doubt we have anybody from Iceland listening, they do have a club that is performing very well there. First quarter traffic trend increased 4.9% worldwide, and within the U.S., around 5.2% average ticket, and this was what I was alluding to with those new members coming on board, average ticket was up 3.7%. So even those new members are finding something in that treasure hunt experience to go ahead and buy at the checkout lanes.
Total cardholders at year's end from last quarter was 94.3 million, and to Layton's point, again, this first quarter's end, 95.4 million. So an increase in the number of Costco cardholders. Let's go now to the call details. And going back to the gross margin compression, we see that they are investing heavily in e-commerce, something they've talked about a lot over the last year to year and a half, as well as growing out their store footprint where they can. They're beginning to run out of some of that ever-present white space that a lot of people saw for Costco about 5 to 10 years ago. And of course, building out the store footprint also includes a small international presence. Layton, of course, spoke about their Canadian sales, which have been good, just not as good as in the United States. Now, the biggest expense for Costco has been building out their e-commerce presence and trying to kind of keep up with the Joneses after neglecting their e-commerce site for so long, trying to implement that quick shipping as well in order to compete with the likes of Walmart, Target, and Amazon in that ever-important grocery realm, even though that realm carries with it fewer margins. Same-day grocery delivery is now available to members within the 20-minute drive of 99% of their locations. You talk about that investment really bearing out on that front. Two-day grocery, which they do for their business center, is available throughout the continental United States, a limited assortment of buy online, pick up in store items as well in 10 of their stores. So still room to grow as far as that true omni-channel presence for Costco. Now, their CFO noted on the call that e-commerce in particular seems to inherently carry lower operating margins. Thus, one of the reasons why you saw the margins not as robust as some were thinking. But, you know, honestly, this is a fact that a lot of people already know, that e-commerce investment coupled with the fact that you're taking hits on a lot of the shipping that you're doing as a company usually leads to lower margins. And we look at Amazon, and, you know, one of Amazon's flaws is in the margin space. And, you know, we saw this week in news that Amazon is considering stopping the sale of lower cost consumables because, in part, customers usually know what they pay for their most commonly bought items, and paying a premium for convenience does not always translate in the grocery space, especially when you're discussing perishables as well. And now with retailers charging a premium on top of a service premium, many are still choosing to forego the convenience and go to the grocery store, go to the brick and mortar outlets for all of their consumables. Still, though, it is at least a positive sign that Costco is putting forth some effort here again. What they were so widely criticized for 2 to 3 years ago is letting their e-commerce presence go stale. Even if Costco still doesn't have a robust online selection, and it wasn't that long ago where just about the only thing you could get in terms of food on Costco's website was basically preparation kits for doomsday. You had these large kits full of canned goods and the like. You couldn't really buy individual items. That has changed for Costco, and it's a positive sign if they can manage to somehow build out those margins on that front. Now, total e-commerce sales for the retailer were up over 25%, which again is a win considering their relatively slow adoption of online services. It's not in that Walmart realm of the 40-50% that we've sometimes seen from them in terms of quarter over quarter growth there. But we expect this growth number to grow a little bit more in the future for Costco because of their absolute amount of online retail sales. Still fairly small there. So in you're comparing to Walmart or other retailers, a lot more runway for Costco. For their stores in particular, IT expense was flat, but hourly wages, something we've heard from just about every retail CEO and CFO, those were higher thanks to raising the store minimum wage and also giving others their annual raises, which for Costco, again, can be fairly robust. Again, Costco, one of the highest paying retail stores out there in the United States. And in general, management predicts that these type of expenses will be in line with what they did expect in the past moving forward. So nothing in terms of massive jumps in terms of pay. And beyond operational expenses, they are paying slightly less in interest expense. And Leighton, they're seeing a benefit from the federal tax increases as well.
So they do expect an effective tax rate for around 27% or so, which is in line with the other retailers we've talked about on this podcast. The lowest I think we've seen is around 22%. Regardless, they have seen a positive benefit from that tax reform that was passed last year. Also, long-term for fiscal 2019, they plan to open around 20 to 23 stores. This number seems low, but they have been consistent with these kind of store openings over the last few years. And by the way, they will also have to factor in more store relocations for their older store base. Typically, we see between 2 and 5 stores per year in the U.S. Again, these are stores that are a little dilapidated. They need some help. They need some refurbishment. And this is a way to bring new stores to areas that already love their current Costco locations. Shares closed down to around $207 on Friday. They have a 52-week high of $245 and a 52-week low of around $175. And so, while shares were down this week, as were a lot of other retailers, down 5 to 10% in some cases, we have to look at the relativity of their stock price. The 52-week low being around $175, think about this. They're up still double digits year over year. So really, this most recent drop-off only gave back around 5 months of gains. So you can look at it in that perspective. The company still has a dividend yield, by the way, of around 1.1% at the current share price, that is, and there is speculation of a fourth special one-time dividend. However, analysts did not really pry too much as executives kept it tight to their chest as to their plans for another one-time dividend. Longtime shareholders have been rewarded with consistent annualized increases in the regular dividend as well as share buybacks. The company is still more or less mature enough to get criticism about earnings woes, yet is still also criticized for not doing enough to expand their business. And we tend to think that they are managed appropriately. So executives are doing the right thing in terms of mixing it up, in terms of capital investment, and also in terms of giving back to their current longtime shareholders, and could afford to maybe, in the grand scheme of things, reinvest more aggressively and forgo another special dividend. You think about that special dividend, I think they've given 3 so far overall over the last few years. If they forego that special dividend and invest more in e-commerce, which by the way is seeing double-digit gains for the business, I think that it would be a good plan for them because other retailers are not slowing down in terms of reinvestment. You don't see Walmart issuing a large special one-time dividend to their shareholders because they've been buying up a lot of smaller e-commerce companies, investing in their e-commerce infrastructure with distribution centers, investing in their stores in terms of grocery pickup. I think Costco could do more of the same, at least for the short term. We're talking the next 1 to 3 years. They could really invest a lot of that cash back into the business. And I think that's going to pay off longer term. Costco's always been a forward thinker and thinking in terms of the next 5 to 10 years. And I think that would really be what the shareholders want in terms of long-term value. After all, they do have a lot of institutional shareholders with Costco. We switch gears from big box retail to pet retail, which is something we tend to talk about, especially with smaller niche retailers like Ollie's Bargain Outlet. And a surprise in the pet retail space, the ever-growing Pet Supplies Plus is sold to Sentinel Capital Partners. Pet Supplies Plus is somewhat differentiated from many other large pet store chains around the United States. Think of Petco, PetSmart, Petland, and PetSense, which is a subsidiary, and that they really rely largely on a franchise model, not unlike a QSR or FSR chain like we had talked about in our now defunct Food Focus podcast. But first, a brief history here as we delve into Pet Supplies Plus. They were founded in 1988 in Redford, Michigan, currently headquartered in Livonia, Michigan. Their real estate profile centers around residential heavy areas rather than the traditional larger retail hubs like the likes of PetSmart and Petco that have really focused on in the recent past. And their stores are also smaller, rarely exceeding 10,000 square feet in size. Generally, they have open concepts with not as many aisles as you might see in a larger pet store. And for those familiar with Tractor Supply Company's recently acquired PetSense store, like I had said, they are a subsidiary of a larger stakeholder. The stores are fairly similar in concept with the exception of the franchise model. Overall, they have 448 stores in their portfolio currently, which seems like a lot because it is a lot. Across 33 states, they are further spread than PetSense even, whose stores are largely in the Midwest. They have yet to make significant inroads in most of the West with the exception of Colorado and California, my new home state.
So Pet Supplies Plus has always been incredibly transparent about sales, despite the fact that they are privately held. Part of this is, of course, due to the fact that they have to attempt to attract new franchisees. One of the things that they're bullish on and noting is average unit volume, which comes in around $2.2 million annually. Now, this is a far cry, of course, from their larger competitors on a per unit basis, even when square footage is included in the calculation. But one thing is for certain in terms of their attempt to attract franchise owners, you know, that $2.2 million average unit volume, that stands out favorably to a lot of QSRs that are out there. So if you're a franchisee that maybe holds a number of other outlets, this is something that you might indeed look at opening up just because it offers potentially more upside on the revenue front, at least, than some QSR concepts do. Now, this number, the sales number, decreases to $1.5 million per store for stores open about 1 year. Stores open 8 to 11 years or over 12 years generally do boast higher sales. Of course, it's kind of a self-selecting issue there. They come in around the $2.5 million neighborhood per calendar year. Granted, if the stores weren't successful, they wouldn't make it 8 to 11 or 12 plus years. Their highest drawing store in fiscal 2018, by the way, pulled in $6.273 million. That's for their fiscal 2018 because, of course, we're not done with the year 2018 just yet. Now, until the sale, Pet Supplies Plus was owned by another private capital firm in Irving Place Capital. Now moving over to Sentinel, and Mark Buon, a principal at Sentinel, noted the steady growth and the increased interest from potential franchisees is major reasons for interest in the retail company. You know, he could talk about some of those things, and although the official press release notes other things such as a passionate consumer base and stability, honestly, Pet Supplies Plus derives as much success in their business model from their differentiation and their location specs. When you look at some of their location specs, they are very specific about where they head off to. They actually prefer grocery-anchored centers over larger shopping complexes, again, jiving with kind of that neighborhood model that they like to espouse. And unlike PetSmart and Petco, they're larger competitors both in terms of size and square footage. Pet Supplies Plus requires over 2 miles between one of their stores and the nearest competing pet store, which usually ensures separation from competition within neighborhood areas. But also, that's certainly a different take, as a lot of times when you head to a certain shopping district in a city, you will see a PetSmart right across the street from a Petco, maybe not in the same shopping center, but certainly within spitting distance. And the same thing goes for other competitors, like, for example, Petland in this space. You see them usually pretty close by to a PetSmart and Petco. In this case, Pet Supplies Plus, very exacting about what they want, and they want that 2 miles before they make a splash into that real estate and before they go ahead and grant that franchise. Now, long term, Sentinel may be banking on the idea that location and convenience will win over consumers because of this neighborhood concept, because you're putting those stores in grocery anchored centers. It's a little bit of a differentiated concept, not only from the big box pet stores, but e-commerce competitors like Chewy. And, you know, Chewy, they're gathering market share, but pet owners still will always need a local outlet for last minute purchases. Like if you run out of dog food, for example, or run out of cat litter, you need that neighborhood store. And Pet Supplies Plus tries to differentiate themselves as a pet store from some of the other grocery stores, from the Dollar Generals of the world that do offer robust pet selections. But at the same time, Pet Supplies Plus can go a little bit deeper, can carry some more of those niche products, can carry more of those natural foods that we're seeing such an increase in within the pet space.
Sentinel primarily invests in franchise models, but not often in the retail space. They have several food investments in Captain D's, Checkers, Fazoli's, TGI Fridays, Southern California Pizza Company, and Huddle House. Additionally, they hold stakes in auto repair centers and home healthcare providers. This will be their first true foray into retail, which is something in and of itself deserves attention. As far as the future is concerned for Pet Supplies Plus, their growth will be only limited in the short term by the ready availability of franchisees. And I think franchisees in food, QSRs, for example, hold many stores within a single brand or a single region even, but this is more difficult to do with PSP. And I think for Pet Supplies Plus, the key is going to be the marketing materials, because this is what a lot of QSRs don't have to do. If you think about the McDonald's of the world, or even talk about a Taco John's franchisee, the marketing materials, not really going to have to explain the true concept. However, with Pet Supplies Plus, you're going to have to say why. Why can we, or how can we, be able to adjust to the larger market and the other retailers in that space that are dominating that space, like we mentioned with those larger retailers? How is this going to be formidable in this space, and how are you going to be able to make a profit 2, 3, 4 years down the line? They have significant runway to grow in the US, however, and I think a lot of this, Trent, has to do with the fact that the pet supplies market is ever growing. People love pets, and not only do they love pets, they love to take care of them. They take care of them in some cases more than they do their own children, but especially since, as we've mentioned before, they have little presence, pet supply stores do, in the western part of the country. And I think this is going to be an opportunity for them to make a huge foray in a space that a lot of other retailers are hesitant to do so because of the cost per square foot. Being a smaller footprint store, this really gives them the opportunity to really grow, because you see the rent per square foot in areas like Southern California, it is just massive. And I think that's one of the reasons why you don't see a lot of common type retailers with 15,000 plus square foot really make a bold entrance into new territory.
Now, coming up, we'll have a nice discussion with Kevin Kelly. He is of the firm Shook Kelly and had a main hand in designing the newest Gelson's Market out in California. We'll talk to him about the idiosyncrasies of trying to design a grocery store, an updated grocery store intended for today's consumer. Now, longtime listeners of the podcast know we love talking about the design of the retail store. Who better to discuss it than with Kevin E. Kelly of Shook Kelly?
who recently designed the new Gelson's Market store in Manhattan Beach. Now, we've seen pictures, video from this store. Looks amazing based on what we can see here. And I know it was certainly a different process in terms of designing that store. But first, as we bring you on the podcast here, what kind of attracted us to this story initially is that there are a lot of misconceptions about grocery store design. What are some of the more popularly held misbeliefs, if you will, about grocery store design that you hear about? And why do these things kind of tend to be untrue from a designer's standpoint?
You know, there's quite often belief that the grocery store is trying to manipulate people into buying a lot more than they need to or want to. And so you commonly hear these stories about, well, we're doing this to try to motivate customers a certain way. And that's actually not true. The grocery stores, as good as they are, they're not able to do that level as giving them too much credit.
So in terms of these misconceptions here, oftentimes you hear about things regarding, oh, well, they want you to go to the back of the store to get milk, that type of thing. But in reality, the design is structured that way for different purposes to where it makes more sense, it seems like, oftentimes to have certain products in certain areas of the store. And in terms of designing a grocery store, why are certain products located where they're at?
You know, a lot of it has to do with logistics and pack out and shelving, and the back of the store is a really good place for load-in to happen, and refrigeration and coolers. So we're generally doing that so we can load from the back of the cases. And so, yes, there is this belief that we're trying to pull you back there and get you to buy more. And that myth is stuck pretty strong and, you know, loud, and it's not really true. We do try to move milk and other products to different areas of the store, and it helps us in terms of kind of helping cross merchandise, but it's a lot more difficult to do the load-in and pack-out and warehouse for that.
Now, in designing a grocery store, particularly one such as Gelson's, which is, again, known for a lot of fresh goods, how much are you able to push kind of that classic envelope, if you will, about how a store is, especially a grocery store, is typically designed?
You know, it's a bit difficult because most grocery stores have been primarily in the business of providing basic products that consumers can select. And obviously the biggest trend that's been happening for the last 20 years is customers out, not cooking at home as much, generally cooking more for special events. And so the grocery stores had to shift more into the restaurant business, and that's been very difficult for them to shift back into the restaurant business.
Now, of course, this Gelson's Market that you helped design does have some of those, what are sometimes called in the industry, those grocerant concepts. What difficulties does that provide from a logistical standpoint as you begin to design these spaces?
You know, it's a completely different type of behavior in the restaurant areas. You know, the whole business model is different. You make money a different way. You're trying to encourage the customer to stay there as long as you can and order as much as they will. I mean, and again, we're not trying to manipulate them, but just the restaurant model is different. And so it's dedicating a lot of space to kind of slow eating. And the regular grocery store, you know, has a lot packed into a square inch. So that's one logistical issue. And then, of course, we have all the basic things such as what to do with your cart, you know, how to staff it. And you oftentimes have to have two different types of staff with two different kind of pay scales and different things that happen. Now, Gelson's didn't have that, but other brands do.
You mentioned something that I think is very interesting regarding this type of concept, which is something as basic as what do you do with the cart? How did you kind of answer for that in this particular circumstance?
You know, we have some great things at the Gelson's where you can go in and you can sit down and order a meal and you can order your groceries while you're there and while you shop. Somebody else takes care of that. And that works really well for both the customer and the store. And we were surprised at how much the customer actually, one, uses that and how much they tend to buy when they're coming in and sitting down and having a drink or eating a meal. So it's worked out really well.
Once again, we're joined by Kevin Kelly of Shook Kelly, who helped to design the new Gelson's Market store in Manhattan Beach. We're talking to him today just about retail, particularly grocery store design, as we get some of the new generations of grocery stores that are popping up. One other emphasis I know Gelson's has just in general is towards the fresh, towards a lot of produce. You've got a juice bar in there. What kind of difficulties does that present logistics-wise as you're thinking through this space?
It's generally not as much of a problem in terms of what Gelson's done because they've always provided a very fresh perspective. And They have an incredibly high level of service and attention to produce, way above the industry norm. Each of the produce people in the department really know their product, so they're accustomed to that. And so, you know, we're, that part at least is pretty easy for us to do. And in terms of a design standpoint, of course, Gelson's has to do a lot to really deliver on that internally, but they do a real good job of that. As you go around the store into the other areas, of the store, we really have to do a lot in terms of presentation of the food product. And so we spend a lot of time thinking about merchandising and trying to understand what customers are looking for as they're going through the store in terms of solutions. And it's a good way to really think about it. Consumers are trying to think in terms of solving meal problems, meal issues. And as you make those presentations, we really try to think about, well, how can we make really good answers to those problems that they have? Easy answers, delicious answers, fast answers for them. So we do a lot of cueing and triggering as we go around the store to help customers.
And you talk about customers looking to find a solution, basically, to meals or a delicious solution there. You are looking to find a solution, basically, to the customer's solution in this case. How much leverage, how much leeway were you given in terms of being able to find new solutions for the consumer as compared to what you see the solutions at in just your traditional retail grocery stores?
You know, Gelson's gave us a lot of latitude and freedom. They've been a great client to work with because they really wanted to think about what the stores of the future will look like and what kind of, you know, new issues and problems can we start solving for customers. And so that was very helpful for us. So we started really thinking about the store, not entirely fixated on what the industry is, which is convenience, a variety of price. The industry gets obsessed about that. And we really actually focused on kind of helping change the relationship of what your traditional grocery store can mean for your customer. And that meant a much more social, experiential, enlightenment kind of occasion to go there. So the customer could go there and learn about the products, sit down and have a glass of wine and talk to their neighbors, and really indulge and engage in kind of a food discovery. And that's been a really big benefit for not only the customer, but it's really helped Gelson's rethink the future a lot. And we were blessed that they let us have that initial attitude to kind of work in this direction. We kind of see that as the future. You know, if you look down the road, we really believe the stores are going to be really focused on hospitality, enlightenment, education, and advice, whereas a lot of grocery stores have been kind of obsessed with price, convenience, even the issue of quality sometimes gets very interpretive.
One of the key facets to that last response was in regards to the experiential nature of where we're kind of seeing grocery headed. In terms of someone that's as embedded with the design facet as you are, what, in your opinion, is the next frontier in grocery design? Where are we headed above and beyond where we're at now?
I think you'll see a day when there's not going to be aisles. Aisles were really built, and I'm really talking about center store aisles. They were really built during a time when you had more demand than you had supply. It's kind of like the Model T Ford, and we ask consumers to go down these narrow aisles that have all of these products out, which really benefited a lot of manufacturers, and it's somewhat overwhelming for the customer. We don't enjoy being in alleys, long corridors as humans. We just generally don't like it, and particularly when they get crowded or other people are in those aisles. And so what we've been trying to do as best we can is break the store down into perceptual rooms, solution zones, and start rethinking that. Health and beauty certainly did that a while ago, but we're looking all the way around the store to do that. So that's one. We see that changing. Checkout is going to be a massive change, and it's not as simple as what Amazon's looking at. It's really trying to rethink how we actually do checkout. A lot of checkout kind of feels like a toll road situation with a residential road cutting across it, you know, and it's a malfunction junction that breaks down every busy day of the week. And so we've been looking at really trying to change that as much as we can. I definitely think you're going to see grocery stores start heading a lot more towards hospitality and a lot more social food occasions and food opportunities in the store. So I think you'll start seeing a lot more pubs, which, you know, you're seeing to some degree, restaurants, bars, oyster bars, you know, a variety of different types of engagement. engagement in the store, kind of the merging of the food hall with a grocery store.
I love that term, solution zones, and certainly we'll be on the lookout for that with the next generation of grocery stores coming around the corner. Well, once again, Kevin E. Kelly of Shook Kelly, thanks so much for joining us here today on the Retail Focus Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure talking with you.
Finally, as far as the news for this podcast is concerned, in a topic we found interesting for some time, Food Business News released their State of the Industry look for dairy. And although this is a topic that might seem more in line with the defunct Food Focus podcast, very important for us to look at trends in dairy as it pertains to the grocery industry. After all, dairy and dairy-driven perishables are products that many grocers still see as traffic drivers. Much the same way we were talking about pet food and running out of pet food for Pet Supplies Plus could be a traffic driver, dairy is a traffic driver in that same way for many brick-and-mortar grocery stores, at least until Amazon's distribution system builds out with fresh goods a little bit further. In many places in the United States, many highly populated places, this is the case, but in places that are either mid-sized markets or more sparsely populated, brick-and-mortar still rules the roost. So this report gives us an eye into a couple of different phenomena surrounding dairy's place in retail stores. One is the slight inflation we've seen in dairy in 2018, and another is consumers' search for non-dairy alternatives. Now, in theory, this combination between inflation of dairy products and a search for non-dairy alternatives by consumers would be a debilitating 1-2 punch for dairy insofar as retail is concerned. But this report notes two important things that are keeping dairy's shelf share in retail stores. These two things, protein content and cheese. So two unusual things. You know, a couple years ago, it might have been yogurt, but what we're seeing now is yogurt starting to shrink back in terms of popularity among consumers. We'll get to that in a bit. But above and beyond both the protein content and cheese, the general trend towards high-protein diets and an increasing acceptance towards fat has kept dairy from hemorrhaging shelf space to the extent that some, including us, expected, and even have some fringe benefits such as sales of butter becoming more robust as they go. Now, let's look at cheese first, Leighton.
Yeah, if you look at the Food Business News study that came out earlier this month, they note a few key points when it comes to cheese. Cheese alternatives struggle to provide similar flavors, mouthfeels, and melting capabilities of actual cheese. Never thought we'd be talking about mouthfeels on the podcast, but Trent, I know that you've tried several non-dairy alternatives as of late, and they all have one of these three facets, but never all three. I think that's the one area in which the research and development areas of some of these food manufacturers are really trying to figure out is how can we get it to be almost identical to conventional cheese. Additionally, the price points of cheese alternatives are still amazingly high. For example, a vegan mozzarella substitute typically runs around $7 to $10 per 8 ounces, where garden variety mozzarella or even fresh whole milk mozzarella runs $4 per 8 ounces. To this point, U.S. cheese consumption is at an all-time high on a per capita basis. The same could not be said for milk, as we have talked about historically here on this podcast. The U.S. consumes, by the way, over 43 pounds per person per year, natural and processed cheese combined, an increase of 12% since 2006. So you're looking at about 1% to 2% per year. This includes cheese consumed through all channels, including retail and food service purchases. So while this is a retail podcast, you do have to take into consideration the quick service restaurants, the full service restaurants, and those quick convenience stores that we often talk about that are now making a lot of things in-house. And retail dollar sales of natural cheese, by the way, increased 0.9% for the year ending July 15th, 2018. This according to Information Resources Incorporated. This, of course, would be bolstered by upward inflationary impacts, but is not reflective of items including cheese, such as snack packs or deli sales. One partnership we've noted in this regard is one between Murray's Cheese and Kroger. When Kroger purchased Murray's, we really didn't think much of it, even wondered aloud on the podcast what the point was in this purchase. However, the Murray's locations within Kroger have become a major focal point of attraction within the store, with samples and the like coming to bear fruit. And to help differentiate them with Walmart and Albertsons Safeway, who boast neither the cheese selection or the sourcing capabilities of Murray's. So we look now, we think maybe that acquisition was timely and maybe it was best for their consumer base that is wanting more and more differentiation in their stores. The main worry, as of late, for dairy, insofar as the retail environment is concerned, is losing refrigerated space to non-dairy milks. And in 2017, total fluid milk retail volume sales were down 2.4%. Again, volumes, not dollar amounts. So we're not talking about the absolute dollar amount sold here. Part of this, by the way, is driven by consumers' increased desire to consume more plant-based food and beverages. In fact, a friend of mine is obsessed with almond milk as of late. The Hartman Group notes that 54% of consumers are striving to consume more plant-based product, and this, of course, comes at the expense of traditional roots. In fact, data suggests that it is these consumers, not necessarily vegans, vegetarians, or the lactose intolerant that is potentially causing this shift. Packaged Facts notes that the percentage of vegetarians and vegans in the retail marketplace has remained somewhat steady, about 15%, but that number of flexitarians has grown. And Trent, I am one of those. I'm looking to see what product is dairy or what product has dairy in it. And I'm honestly trying to avoid, more times than not, those historical products that I've bought that have dairy in them. According to their research, around 82% of non-dairy milk buyers also buy dairy milk, or at least half and half. Only 5% of this group, and including you, Trent, purchase non-dairy milk because of the lactose intolerance. And despite our personal liking to this, only 5% is a key demographic in the dairy industry, and it's attempting to bring that number back. IRI notes that lactose-free milk sales were up 11.5% in 2017. In addition, grass-fed milk volumes were up 47% over that same time period, and whole fat milk volumes were up slightly at 2.9%, a number that you and I were actually surprised about. We were expecting that to be in the negative territory. Protein-enhanced milk drink volumes were up 8.3% because, by the way, that is a macroeconomic trend. Everyone is trying to have more protein in their diet, and if it can come in liquid form, consumers are going to be drawn to it.
Now, one other trend that we've been noticing surrounding dairy coming into this year is the massive amount of shelf share devoted to yogurt. In fact, some newly renovated Kroger's that I've been to recently have almost 2 to 3 times the shelf space for yogurt as were devoted to them prior to that. But that may not last too much longer. As we look at yogurt retail volume sales, according to those same IRI numbers, we're down 4.8% for all of 2017. Now that we've got those numbers in, Greek yogurt fell 4.9%, and some niche categories grew slightly. These niche categories in growth stage include full-fat yogurts, much like whole-fat milk. Those were up nearly 18% versus the previous year. And whole-fat yogurts grew 3% in market share as well. Now, the one thing that did grow slightly, and this is more towards Layton's point regarding drinking protein in beverage form, yogurt beverages were also up slightly. Finally, the one area where full fat may not be winning out on grocery store shelves, actually in the freezer section, where low-fat ice creams have eaten up significant shelf share. Halo Top is, of course, a big driver in this space. Most stores have begun to introduce private label versions as well, Albertsons, Safeway, and Kroger among them. However, this too may be short-lived, at least as far as dairy is concerned, as we've seen chains like Kroger, for example, partner with Halo Top to increase shelf space devoted towards their non-dairy lines, and we've seen other brands like So Delicious have some success with the non-dairy ice creams in addition. Now, overall, while there are spots where there appear to be positives for dairy, the general trend still somewhat concerning, and while we haven't seen dairy's drop-off as a staple item be as sharp as what we anticipated, yogurt's losses and that continued drop of milk volume consumption suggests future reorganization for grocers. That's a lot of shelf space you got to take care of. And more importantly, if they can cut down on the refrigerated shelf space long term, that's going to be a benefit for them. Now, more so than the middle aisles, shelf space is so fiercely competitive in the refrigerated goods section. It's a lot easier to, let's say, add an end cap of a new product in the dry goods section. Tougher in refrigerated goods, in part because a lot of stores don't have the space to devote to end caps or features regarding refrigerated goods. We do expect to see some of yogurt's shelf share taken over by a wider variety of prepackaged cheeses as people begin to kind of follow Kroger's lead with that Murray partnership Layton was discussing. However, we also expect that share given up by milk will continue to move towards non-dairy milks on the shelves. And we're seeing a lot of different non-dairy milk products. A lot of, Leighton mentioned almond milk earlier, a lot of different brands entering that space, some in the premium space, some in the budget space. So a lot of room to move there in non-dairy milks, and further, more meat and dairy alternatives may creep into those spaces for vegans and for those flexitarians as they become commercially viable and those price points continue to decrease over time.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I give you one story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. We start with Leighton.
Well, I'm going to switch gears entirely and talk about a privately held company that we have never talked about on the podcast up to this point. So around 3 years now we've been doing the podcast. Gymboree has not come across our radar. We apologize to the executives at that particular company. They are in the news this week as they are seeking bankruptcy protection. They're filing Chapter 11 bankruptcy for a second time in less than 2 years. People say that the store is struggling for a number of reasons, and of course it has to do, namely, with the lack of e-commerce presence. So the Chapter 11 that they had filed for back in September of 2017, they closed 360 stores. They were supposed to reorganize, as most retailers try to do when you have over 1,000 stores in the United States. However, they were not able to restructure in such a way that made them sustainable for the long term. So they're mostly known for selling kids' clothes since 1986. And to be honest with you, their assortment has really grown over the past couple of decades, but not grown as much as you think it would. And if you go on their website, gymboree.com, they really don't have a lot of accessories for sale. You would think they would have a lot more. 0 to 14 years of age is sort of the target group that they're trying to identify with. And to be honest, Trent, I think a lot needs to be done in the e-commerce space. Again, going back to the whole reason why they filed for bankruptcy protection in the first place. And this is sort of a rare niche retailer that emerged from bankruptcy and that stayed around for a while. Everyone was thinking they were going to be okay because guess what? They kept 900 stores available for the U.S. consumer, but those stores underperforming, those over 300 that they closed, it did not do enough in order to make the company have a little bit more liquidity. So lenders and creditors, again, feeling the pressure, they probably missed several payments leading up to this Chapter 11 bankruptcy. We can only hope that they remain open in some capacity. The rumors are, thus far, that their brands are going to stay in some form or fashion, but it's sort of unclear as to how many stores exactly they are going to be closing. Supposedly, they are hoping to keep nearly 100 stores still available for their customer base. However, the San Francisco-based company said that they were unsure about their debt load and how they can actually move forward from here. They had a 2010 leveraged buyout, by the way, and so I think, back to Toys R Us, that leveraged buyout killed them in the end because consumers were still going to their stores, but they just did not have the right dollars to market their products. They didn't have the right dollars to expand their e-commerce presence because they were paying such a high debt load every single month. And that may have well been the case with Gymboree.
So my looking ahead story has to do with the U.S. grocery industry. We just talked about dairy after all, but Kantar came out with a report that Aldi had nearly $31 billion in U.S. sales in 2018, and sales compound annual growth rate of 9% over the course of 5 years from 2013 to 2018. Going forward over the next 5 years, they expect a compound annual growth rate of 10%, they being Kantar. Now, this is what I'm looking forward to. Aldi, not a retailer we talk about a lot, but they have been remodeling a number of stores. They have been expanding to a number of new markets. I actually live in a market that's fairly untouched by Aldi to this point. But as they expand, just where does that market share takeover kind of stop? Now, Kantar mentioned in the study that shoppers are perceiving Aldi more along the lines of how they would perceive a higher up retailer, like, for example, Whole Foods 365. I'm not sure that that's entirely true, but Aldi has certainly improved their game as far as which merchandise they are carrying in their stores and improving the overall visibility of all their private label brands that they have in stores. But my looking ahead is just how much further can Aldi go when you have retailers like Walmart and Kroger making these massive price investments to get down close to where Aldi is in terms of price point. So can Aldi continue to scrape by with market share gains against these other retailers when in reality some of their prices are now in line with some of the other larger competitors here in the United States? Now, that being said, again, Aldi, private company, so we probably won't get these answers easily. The answers will likely have to come from larger data sets like the ones provided by the likes of Cardlytics, let's say, or other data analyst firms like Kantar. But once again, something worth keeping an eye on: does Aldi's growth slow against these robust growth projections? And what do they do about the price investments of other retailers that have now put other retailers very similarly into their value play? Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. Once again, a big thanks to Kevin Kelly of Shook Kelly for joining us on the show. And a reminder, next week, coming up next week, is our annual countdown of who we feel to be the top five performing retailers in 2018 and maybe the bottom five in terms of retail performance in 2018. A reminder that always our bottom five does not include anyone that declared bankruptcy. For the first time in the history of the podcast, Sears will not be on the bottom five. Tune in to find out who took their spot. Again, that's next week on the Retail Focus podcast.
This has been the Retail Focus podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.